You know, I think all of you are well aware that I have a tendency to give a series of sermons. Perhaps you might have noticed that. You know, I'll give a couple of sermons and they'll tie together. Sometimes I give four or five, maybe even six in a series. And one time many years ago, some of you might remember this, I gave a over 30 sermon series on the history of Jerusalem. But I got to thinking, why should I do all the work? Why not have somebody else give a part one? And I could just pick up with the part two. And I found the perfect opportunity to do that today. You might have noticed that we're exactly halfway between the Feast of Trumpets, which was last Sabbath, and the first day of the Feast of Tabernacles, which is next Sabbath. And so I got to thinking, I have know what I kind of want to speak in today, but I really needed a part one. And so I didn't talk to either Mr. Lydia or Mr. Sanderlands about what they're giving on the Feast of Trumpets, but I kind of knew about what they were going to give. They're probably going to talk in some way, shape, or form about the return of Christ. And Mr. Sanderlands, thank you, Mr. Sanderlands, gave me the perfect part one to lead in to my sermon today. As you might recall, he was speaking of the meaning of the day and talking about a broad outline of the things that were going to happen. He was focusing on Jesus Christ and when will he ascend to his throne, which will be on earth. And so he took us through a lot of scriptures related to the return of Christ and him finally receiving that throne. And so that's what I needed. That was my part one. And so today, my part two is going to be related to what happened, what was the situation after the day of the Lord. Think about it for a minute. Absolute disaster. Absolute chaos. And we see disasters and chaos. That's not so unusual. We just big Turkey earthquake, 50,000 people killed. But at least there were other areas, other people who didn't suffer any disasters that were able to come in and send help, bring food, water, supplies, tents for people to sleep under. But think about it, the day after the day of the Lord, the whole world will be in pretty much the same situation. No place to live. No food, no water. What's going on here? So this is what I'm going to be talking about today. So this is my part two, courtesy of Mr. Sandlands, part one. The day after the day of the Lord. Now, put yourself in that day. Now, I'd say pretty much 100% of the time, when you imagine yourself, if you've ever done this, if you imagined yourself being on the day after the day of the Lord, you're thinking about flying around. You're thinking about a new spirit body. I can fly. My brain has blown up and expanded. But think about it from the perspective of someone who wasn't us, who wasn't resurrected to spiritual life when Christ returned, who somehow, amazingly, survived all this. Like this young woman I've shown you here with her baby who had survived the earthquake. Can you imagine yourself just sitting there, destruction all around you, Half or maybe all of your loved ones died. you know, what would be going through your mind if you found yourself in that position? What would it be like on the day after the day of the Lord? Well, that's what I want to talk about today. Let me start. We talk about disasters all the time. We've had some. I mentioned the Turkey earthquake. I'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. But we've had some disasters of different kinds. The forest fires and stuff, and earthquakes, and volcanoes. You know, these kind of things happen. But how bad will it really be on the day after the day of the Lord? What will the earth look like? So let's start with what is a disaster? And dictionary.com defines it as a calamitous event, especially one occurring suddenly, causing great loss of life, damage, or hardship, as a flood, airplane crash, or a business failure. So as disasters go, the greatest disaster ever in the history of the earth will have just finished on the day after the day of the Lord. Now, looking backwards in time, you know, what has been the greatest disaster so far in the history of humankind? Most people might think of the flood. I mean, after all, every single person on the earth was killed except for just a handful of people. That's pretty bad. But then the population of the earth was probably, you know, population experts talk about up until about 1500, population of the earth kind of hovered around 300, 400 million, something like that, compared to the 7 billion today. So the destruction that's coming will be the greatest disaster ever. It hadn't got there yet. Some might bring up something a little more esoteric, like the greatest disaster being Adam and Eve eating the forbidden fruit. That led to a pretty big disaster. But we've seen some recent disasters. And if you recognize what this is Lahaina in Maui. After that disaster, the forest fire that ran through that town, destroying practically everything in it. It's just horrifying to see some of the pictures. Cars burned up with people still inside where they were trying to escape. They had so very little warning. You know, people in their homes consumed by this sudden raging fire. When I saw this picture, it reminded me of another picture. You recognize this picture? That's Hiroshima. After it was received the first atomic bomb towards the end of World War II. It didn't look that much different from what Lahaina looked like after that fire spread through. So we've got a lot of disasters, but they tend to be isolated, some bigger than others, times of war, some much bigger than others. But the disaster that's coming is going to leave a world that's completely unrecognizable to you and I. You know, just think for a moment. Say Christ does not come for another 100 years. I think it's safe to say nobody in this room will still be alive at that time. All right, but Christ comes, you're resurrected, and you will see a world that you probably will not recognize. You probably think, wow, is this my planet? And they put me on some distant planet that's all destruction and craters and stuff like that. What's going on here? Yeah, no, it'll be Earth. So let's go. I'm going to go back and look at a timeline here to begin with. It's Christ's return being zero day. So if we start backing up, as Mr. Sandilands mentioned in his sermon, the seventh seal, when that's open, that's generally when we accept the idea that the day of the Lord begins then. And that's what it specifically says, at that time, the day of the Lord is starting. And we believe that's a year, a prophetic year of 360 days. I'll get back to that in just a minute here. But we go back 3.5 years, times time and a half, we come to 1,260 days at the Great Tribulation begins. And if we go back a little bit further to 1,290 days, that's when the daily sacrifices will be replaced by the abomination of desolation in the temple, or on the temple grounds at least. And if we go back just a little bit further, 1,335 days, well, nobody exactly knows exactly what that means. In Daniel 12:12, he was told, "Blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1,335 days. But we don't seem to know exactly what that means. There's some speculation. If you watched Mr. Joel Meeker's FI Online series on Daniel and Revelation, he speculates that it may be when the church's work ends, that it's over, and we can no longer preach the gospel. Doesn't mean the church is over, but he speculates that's one possibility. But we don't really seem to know. I wonder if maybe it has something to do with the two witnesses. Again, just pure speculation. But in the timeline, the two witnesses, they're resurrected right around the time of the sixth trump, which means there's a time lag that before Christ returns. So you wonder, well, maybe they, when they were resurrected, you know, we think, oh, yeah, they're resurrected along with everybody else. It kind of sounds like they might be resurrected sooner. Perhaps like Elijah was, and removed to a place of safety until the resurrection. We don't know, but maybe that's what it's talking about. But it's pure speculation. We simply don't know. But as God told Daniel, go your way. It will be understood in times to come. But we haven't reached that point yet. Now, look at Isaiah 34, verse 8. I want to go back to this 360 days of the day of the Lord. For it is the day of the Lord's vengeance, the year of recompense for the cause of Zion. So that's one of the reasons that we think that the day of the Lord is a prophetic year by this particular scripture. It refers to it as a day and as a year. And in addition to that, we look at Revelation 6:17. Now, this occurs after the sixth seal and is at the beginning of the seventh seal. Revelation 6:17, for the great day of his wrath has come, who is able to stand? So this is clearly a period of time that's going to elapse. And the fifth trumpet, let me bring that up. When the fifth trumpet sounds, and Mr. Sandilands mentioned this in his sermon, that's where the locusts come out and there's 5 months of torment of the people. That means at least 5 months before Christ comes, during this period of the day of the Lord. So this is the kind of evidence we use to say, well, it looks like it's going to be about a year. All right, so what I'm looking at today is none of this. I'm looking at the day after year zero, the aftermath of the day of the Lord. And the way I want to approach this, well, with the general question, first of all, what is the condition of the world the day after Christ returns? What do you think? Will he have suddenly say, I'm here, wave his hand, and the death, the destruction, it'll all be gone, and all of a sudden, houses pop up, gardens grow, water flows everywhere. Well, some water will flow everywhere. The Bible describes that. But will it all be just by a wave of God's hand? Or will there be a time frame? Notice that, and we're observing the holy days, Feast of Trumpets, 15 days before we observe the beginning of the millennium. So we don't know exactly what kind of time frame that's being talked about here. But there's going to be a rebuilding period. And it's not going to be simply God waves his hand and everything is perfect. Now, let's talk about the survivors. There will be 9 groups of survivors that next day after the day of the Lord. First of all, in the physical world, in other words, people who have physically survived. I'm not sure how anybody will survive that, but there's some Jews in Israel that will survive. There's Jews scattered around other nations that will survive and begin returning to Israel. There's Israelites scattered about other nations, some who don't have any idea that they're Israelites. And then there's the non-Christians and pseudo-Christians the world over, the bulk of probably the survivors, because that's the bulk of the population of the world. And so those are the ones that are in the physical world. And then there's the spiritual world, the spiritual survivors. Of course, the Christians alive at the first resurrection will be spirit beings. Christians dead at the first resurrection, they will also be spirit beings. And then there's the Old Testament converted Israelites, people like Moses, David, Elijah, different ones. They'll be resurrected. And then, of course, there'll be God and his angels, and Satan and his demons. Now, this first group will be absolutely shattered. This second group will be absolutely rejoicing, with one exception, of course, Satan and his demons, who, even though survive, are put away for 1,000 years. So, what I want to focus on is this first group, these that are left alive. What will it look like? And I want to break it down into categories. Earthquakes and volcanoes. Let's talk about that. Earthquakes, and I'm only going to focus on the day of the Lord that year, which begins at the seventh seal opening. Now, just focus on that time, because things happened before that, but we're going to focus on just that cataclysmic time. Now, give you a timeline here. Here are the 7 trumps as they open. The first earthquake will be right before the seal is open, before the first trump sounds. Revelation 8, verses 5 and 6. Then the angel took the censer, filled it with fire from the altar, threw it to the earth, and there were noises, thunderings, lightnings, and an earthquake. So the 7 angels who had their trumpets prepared themselves to sound. Now, my mindset has always been, listen for that first trumpet. But what maybe we really should be looking for is the earthquake. And as soon as there's a massive earthquake, start listening. See if a trumpet starts sounding anytime soon. Because that could be the signal. A massive earthquake is going to happen just before the trumpet sound. Of course, a lot of other things are going to happen, and by the time we get to that point, the Great Tribulation has been well underway for years. But big earthquake happens as these trumpets are getting ready to sound. Okay, then we'll jump over to the opening of the fifth seal. I mentioned this a little bit earlier, too. Revelations 9, verses 1 and 2. Then the fifth seal sounded, and I saw a star fallen from heaven to earth. To him was given the key to the bottomless pit, and he opened the bottomless pit, and smoke arose out of the pit, like the smoke of a great furnace. So the sun and the air were darkened because of the smoke of the pit. So here we're seeing the earth open up. Now, it could be a huge earthquake, but it sounds kind of like a volcano because all the stuff that comes out. Now, this is when the locusts come out and torment the people. So obviously, there's a man-made part of this coming out. As Mr. Sandilands talked about, he envisioned the helicopters in the Vietnam era. But now, you know, it may be something very different in terms of this is. But it's either volcano or earthquake associated with it. And I might mention, you know, God designed the earth, and he designed it with the potential of having earthquakes and volcanoes and so forth. And scientists like to kind of think, well, whatever happened in the Bible, it was really just some natural phenomenon that just happened to occur exactly when the Israelites needed to cross the Red Sea or whatever. You know, or when the water turned to blood, there was a volcano in Italy that had exploded about that time, and the wind was blowing towards Egypt, and all that stuff came and dropped down on the Nile, and it turned red. You know, things like that. There are natural disasters. But God, when his hand takes hold of this earth, at that time, there's not going to be anything natural about it. And people will know it. All right, so that's the second earthquake during the day of the Lord. Then just before the seventh trumpet sounds. Revelations 11, verses 12 and 13. And they heard a loud voice from heaven saying to them, "Come up here," and they ascended to heaven. Now, this is talking about the two witnesses. They ascended to heaven in a cloud, and the enemy saw them, and in the same hour there was a great earthquake, and a tenth of the city fell. In the earthquake, 7,000 people were killed, and the rest were afraid and gave glory to God of heaven. Okay, so this is occurring when the two witnesses are killed, they're resurrected. Huge earthquake happens at that time. All right, then, after the seventh trump sounds, Revelation 11, 19. Then the temple of God was opened in heaven, and the ark of his covenant was seen in his temple, and there were lightnings, noises, thunderings, an earthquake, and great hail. Okay, so now we're up to four earthquakes over the course of this approximately 1 year period. But there's one more. It's the final of the last seven plagues after the seventh trumpet is sounded. That's the fifth earthquake that we have documented. Revelation 16, verses 16 through 18. And they gathered them together in a place in Hebrew called Armageddon. And then the seventh angel poured out his bowl into the air. And a loud voice came out of the temple of heaven from the throne saying, "It is done." And there were noises and thunderings and lightnings. And there was a great earthquake. Such a mighty and great earthquake has not occurred since men were on the earth. The big one. That earthquake is going to be huge. So we have these six earthquakes, boom, five earthquakes, boom, 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 over the course of the earth, rattling the earth. Now, I mentioned the Turkey earthquake. It occurred in this year. Pretty bad. 50,000 people died this one. This is an overview of a portion of the city where the earthquake occurred. You can see there's a lot of debris all around. And some buildings stood. You know, you see some buildings standing. This stadium, you see, is full of tents where survivors are trying to survive. It was a 7.8 magnitude earthquake. Let me show you a view closer to ground level so you can look at that. And let me bring up my pointer here. Okay? If you start looking at these buildings, look at this one here. It seems to be leaning the wrong way. This one seems to be leaning the other way. And look at that one back here. Boy, that one's really leaning. And then a lot of them have just collapsed. Now, why are some of these buildings standing and some of them just piles of rubble? Well, I'm a structural engineer. I know how to design, quote unquote, earthquake-proof buildings. But no building is earthquake-proof. But we do design for earthquakes. Now, we didn't begin to seriously design for earthquakes until about 50 years ago. And since then, the design procedures, and it's basically understanding the movements during an earthquake and how do you design, so forth. But any building that's over about 30, 40 years old probably wasn't seriously designed for earthquakes. They may have tried a little bit, but they just didn't have the knowledge yet at that time. And so I would dare say most of these buildings that collapsed or partially collapsed probably older than 40 years or more. But imagine, most of these buildings are, you got a concrete foundation, reinforced concrete columns, pretty small little columns, but a bunch of them. Concrete slab, more columns, another concrete slab, more columns, another concrete. Looks like some, this building right here, for example, looks to be about five stories. Now, its design, those columns on the bottom floor, they're designed to carry the entire weight of that structure, plus all the furnishings that are in it and equipment that is in it, plus people. It's designed to carry all that load vertically. Plus, if it's in a area where it snows, it's designed to carry a snow load on the roof, on top of that. All that load goes into those columns on the bottom floor. Now, it's also designed for wind loads, lateral loads, blowing on the side of the building. Now, the thing is, lateral wind loads don't put the same kind of lateral forces on these buildings as an earthquake does. So you've got this building, this massive weight here, and I'm sure all of you remember Newton's laws, that an object at rest will remain at rest unless a force is applied to it, and that's exactly what happens in an earthquake. Basically, an earthquake, there's some up and down movement, but basically you've got these massive plates, they call them, that have cracks in them. You know, the crust of the earth has cracks, and then you have the solid part. And the earth is kind of alive. It moves. And pressure builds up, and these two plates where those faults are, pressure builds up to one slides over the other. That causes the earthquake. And so basically what's happening is suddenly the foundation that these columns are attached to suddenly jerks feet, 5, 6, 7 feet. That building doesn't want to move. The mass of weight doesn't want to move. And so when it's jerked sideways like this, these columns come into a tremendous bending force, which they were not designed for, unless they were very modern buildings. And even then, there's a certain level of earthquake that it's designed for. And so these buildings collapse. Or in this case, this one's leaning this way. What I suspect here, that the columns down here at this end are the ones that collapsed and just tilted the building over. This one here, it looks like maybe the columns at this end are the ones that collapsed. And so it's leaning the other way. This one here, looks like all the columns along one side collapsed because they just couldn't take those kind of lateral forces by... Basically, you kind of think of it, you're standing on a skateboard and somebody suddenly jerks it out from under you. Okay. Now, if your feet are laced to that skateboard, what's going to happen to you? You might want to break a hip or something if it's jerked hard enough. Well, that's what's going on with earthquakes. And that's why they're so damaging. So why did this earthquake happen here? Well, look at this map. little hard to see. The background's kind of light there. But this is Turkey. This area here is Turkey. We got the Mediterranean Sea down here, Syria here. Israel is right down here. That's where Israel is. And you can see that you have, again, these plate tectonics. These are where the cracks between these various plates are, these red lines. And so you have this Anatolian plate, the African plate, the Arabian plate, and they all kind of come together right here. Surprise, surprise, there was an earthquake. A 7.8 quake followed by a second quake of 7.5. And this is what we don't think about too much when there's an earthquake. It's just not one event and it's over. They're the aftershocks. In this case, the aftershock was almost equal to the original earthquake. And there are lots of aftershocks. Sometimes they go on for months, the aftershocks. But what's interesting here is looking at where these fault lines go in terms of all the earthquakes I just described. This fault line runs right down the Jordan Valley. How far do you suppose that fault line is from Jerusalem? Oh, probably 20 miles maybe, something like that. Not far at all. And then let me bring up the scripture, Revelation 16, verses 19 and 20. Now, the great city was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell, and great Babylon was remembered before God to give her the cup of wine of the fierceness of his wrath. Then every island fled away, and the mountains were not found. So this is a massive earthquake. Massive. And you can see why it can be spread so far because of all these fault lines. Look, there's fault lines here. This is Cyprus right here. So there's fault lines there. You move over here. Here's Crete. And there's a fault line there. And so the islands are going to disappear. These are mountains up in here. Mountains are going to disappear. And notice where these fault lines are running. They're running to the rest of Europe. Let's blow it up a little bit more. Okay, here showing this, some of these fault lines here, some out here in the Mediterranean Sea. But look at this one here. This runs up the Achilles tendon of Italy as a fault line. And if we go up a little bit more, now we're looking at all, look at these fault lines all in Europe. How far do you think this fault line that runs down the back of the boot of Italy, how far do you think that is from Rome? It's probably not more than 50 miles, something on that order. this is North Africa here, Gibraltar, Spain. But see this fault line right here? This is Morocco. Just had an earthquake in Morocco. So this gives you an idea when talking about the greatest earthquake ever. It's going to rock half the entire world, if not all of the entire world, this one earthquake. This is how severe it is. But don't worry. You can relax because you live in Louisiana. And notice this. There's nothing in Louisiana that indicates there might be an earthquake. Most of all of it, the darker the color, the more likely there might be an earthquake. Most of it's out here on the West Coast. Yeah, there's an area here in New Madrid, Missouri. Back in the early 1800s, there was a humongous earthquake centered in New Madrid. We didn't have seismographs back then to measure it, but witnesses said it was such an earthquake that the Mississippi River flowed backwards. And then likewise, a long time ago, there was one in South Carolina. So they rank these as possibly earthquake zones. But you can see most of the East, not a big deal, not much chance of earthquake. And we don't have any chance. So we can just sit back and just relax and wait for the next hurricane. Now let me point out one other thing as we go through this too. Back when the prophets were writing about these the last days and Christ's return, back when John was writing in Revelation, the world was a much smaller place. Matter of fact, the known world was pretty much within this circle. Yeah. Apparently they had no idea there was a North America and a South America, or an Australia. And they didn't know what was over here, if there was much of anything. And so a lot of times when they're writing, when they're being inspired to talk about things, they talk about it in terms of, you might say, the known world at that time. And when they say that, as we'll talk about in a minute, that a star falls into the sea and it turns to blood, that may be not talking about the whole world. Maybe just talking about the Mediterranean Sea. But a lot of this is going to be centered in this area, but it's going to be felt throughout the entire world. What's the greatest earthquake we've had in modern times? Anybody know? Since seismographs were invented, what's the greatest earthquake we've ever had in the world? Well, interestingly enough, it occurs in Peru. Chile. Chile, this is the lower tip of the South America. Chile runs up the coastline on the western side of the South American continent. In May 22nd of 1960, I never even heard of this before. Anybody heard of the Great Chilean Earthquake? It's the worst, in terms of magnitude, it's the worst earthquake in modern history since seismographs were put in place. I hadn't either, and I thought to myself, 1960 was a pretty big year, particularly May of that year, because that's when my father died in a plane crash at the end of the month. I thought, well, maybe I hadn't heard of it because I wasn't paying much attention to news, world news at that time. But anybody else ever heard of that earthquake? I hadn't. But it was a big one. It generated a tsunami about 35 feet high. I'm not sure how tall this building is, but it's probably not much taller than 35 feet. About a 3 or 4 story building is what we're talking about, tall. In Chile, 1,655 were killed, 3,000 injured, 2 million homeless, $550 million in damages. That was Chile, which was not a huge population in Chile there. And let's look at the fault lines here. In this case, you have the Antarctic plate, the South American plate, and the Nazca plate. And notice they all kind of joined together at Valdivia, where that earthquake hit. Now, the reason I'm showing you this is not because of that, but because how far spread the effects of this earthquake was. It spread roughly halfway around the world in terms of this destruction. What you're looking at here, here's the epicenter of the earthquake. This is the movement in time of the tsunamis. This is 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours, 10 hours, 15 hours, 20 hours. So by the time it got to Japan, it was a day later, 24 hours later. Got to the United States somewhere between a half a day, along about a half a day later. So how much damage did, and then there's Hawaii sitting out here somewhere. How much damage did it do? Hawaii, 61 dead, and 75 million in damage. Japan, you'd think it would kind of die out by the time the tsunami got that far. 138 dead, another $50 million in damage. The Philippines, way over here, kind of sheltered a little bit by Australia. But you got the Philippines, 32 dead, and $500,000 in damage. All that from an earthquake halfway around the earth. Now, the U.S. West Coast, no one died, but there was $500,000 worth of damage there. And then there was the aftershocks. I mentioned the aftershocks. Over the next few days or weeks, there were four aftershocks greater than 7.0 on the Richter scale. In addition to that, this earthquake occurred on May 22nd of 1960. 2 days later, a volcano erupted there. Puyuhu volcano erupted for several weeks with mile-high ash. So it's not unusual to have volcanic activity with the earthquake. Now, we're only talking about, I don't know when seismographs started being regularly used, but it's only been, maybe 50 or 75 years at most, something like that. So, but look at the kind of damage that was done here, just through the effect of an earthquake, followed by a volcano, followed by additional, you know how long the aftershocks lasted in this earthquake? From May 22nd through the middle of November, there were aftershocks. So when these things happen, it's not just the day, but then it's the aftershocks and the opening of a volcano and who knows what else. So here you have the earth under attack from earthquakes. We've listed five that are clearly identified here in the Bible. But that's not all. As quoted in Isaiah 13, verse 13, "Therefore I will shake the heavens, and the earth will move out of her place in the wrath of the Lord of hosts in the day of his fierce anger." And it's clear this is talking about Christ's return if you look at earlier scriptures, like verse 9, for example, if you go back and look at that. What is it God talking about here? Well, earth's kind of a complicated deal. It's orbiting around the sun, and its orbit is roughly circular, but it's slightly elliptical. Now, this drawing shows it exaggerated some from what it really is. But what scientists have discovered, and it's mainly because of the huge outer planets, Saturn, Jupiter, Neptune, those huge planets, their gravitational effect affects Earth's orbit. And so while it's basically circular, over a period of time, it gets more elongated, like is shown here. Now, the cycle where it's most elongated and it's least elongated is over 400,000 years. It's kind of a slow effect. Apparently, the scientists think we're about in the about a 1,000-year mark of the cycle, and it's going to get worse before it gets better. But it's very slow. I don't think any of us have to worry too much about it in our lifetimes unless God intervenes. But then we have the tilt. The tilt, the angle of the rotation of the earth, it's not a constant. Now, it takes about 41,000 years for this tilt to go through its largest tilt to its smallest tilt and back to its largest tilt again. It ranges between 21.5 and 24.5 degrees. It's currently at 23.5. I'm not sure whether it's increasing or decreasing at this point, but it's in the middle of a 41,000-year cycle. And then there's the spin. You know how tops spin and they kind of wobble? They're spinning about an axis, but they're also wobbling. Did you know the Earth wobbles? But it's only somewhere between 19 and 24,000 years for one wobble to create, but I do have a nice slide of the earth wobbling. So what you've got here it starts as wobble, and 20,000 years or so later, it's back in the same position. So this thing is moving around. Now, what God is saying is this is going to change. All these things are going to be impacted. The earth is going to be moved out of its place. And what's that going to do to the people that are living on the earth? I don't know. But look at Isaiah 24, verse 19 and 20. The earth is violently broken. The earth is split open. The earth is shaken exceedingly. The earth shall reel to and fro like a drunkard. I don't know about you, but I'm not sure I want to be there riding that earth when it's reeling like a drunkard. Now, this is in addition to all the volcanoes and earthquakes. And we haven't even gotten some of the good stuff yet. The darkness, the sun, moon, and stars grow dark. Revelation 8:12. The fourth angel sounded, and a third of the sun was struck, a third of the moon, and a third of the stars, so that the third of them were darkened. A third of the day they did not shine, and likewise the night. This darkness, and this is the fourth angel sounding. So this is somewhere between a year and 150 days out from Christ's return. This is going out there a ways. You know, it's at least a half a year away that this starts happening. What happens when we don't have sunlight? You don't have good harvest. And sometimes you don't have harvest at all. Now, of course, some of this will be in form of volcanoes, but all of this is going to be from the hand of God. Isaiah 13, verses 9 and 10. Behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel, with both wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate. He will destroy his sinners from it, for the stars of heaven and their constellations will not give light. The sun will be darkened in its going forth, and the moon will not cause its light to shine. It's going to be a dark, scary place, shaking all over the place. You know, people there will be shaking. The earth itself is going to be shaking. It's going to be scary. And then there's Matthew 24, verse 29. Immediately after the tribulation, now we're getting down towards Christ's return here. After the tribulation of those days, the sun will be dark and the moon will not give us light. The stars will fall from heaven and the powers of the heaven will be shaken. There is a lot of stuff going on here with just the light. And, you know, there's something called the Little Ice Age. Ever heard of the Little Ice Age? That was about the 12th to the 15th century A.D. There were several volcanoes that created a lot of cover in the upper atmosphere. And they didn't have much food. The plants didn't grow well when they don't have any light much. And there was a significant decrease in light during the planting seasons and growing seasons. Joel 3, verse 12 through 15, let the nations be wakened and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat, for there I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations. Put in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come down, for the winepress is full. The vats overflow, for their wickedness is great. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision. For the earth of the Lord, for the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. The sun and moon will grow dark, and the skies will diminish their brightness. And this is from NASA talking about the effect of volcanoes on light. And when a volcano explodes, there's the ash, and the ash usually falls out pretty quickly. But the sulfur dioxide, the carbon dioxide, the hydrogen chloride, which produces acid rain, and hydrogen fluoride, all these things have an effect, but it's particularly the sulfur dioxide, that combines with some of this hydrogen, and it produces sulfuric acid. And the sulfuric acid, as you see in the little write-up beside there, this is from NASA, it condenses very rapidly into what they call sulfate aerosols. They're like little crystals that reflect the sun back into space. And so that's a big problem. That's what the big problem is with volcanic eruptions. All right, so now, next category, the sky is falling. Some earthquakes, you have this and the other, but at least I don't have to worry about things falling on my head much. Well, maybe you do in earthquakes, but what about when the sky starts falling? First trump sounds, Revelation 8:7. The first angel sounded, and hail and fire followed, mingled with blood, and they were thrown to the earth, and a third of the trees were burned up, and all the green grass was burned up. That sounds scary. That sounds like globally what Lahaina experienced. These massive fires that just rage. It burns up everything. The grass, the trees. And then the second one is Revelation 8, verses 8 and 9. Then the second angel sounded, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea, and a third of the sea became blood, and a third of the living creatures in the sea died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. This is one where you wonder if they're not specifically focusing on the Mediterranean Sea, but it would have worldwide effects, clearly. Now, did I skip one? What did I do here? This great mountain, that's an asteroid, as big as a mountain. Now, we have a few asteroids that have hit the Earth that we know of. One was in Canada, the Sudbury asteroid. Now, this is using ground-penetrating radar type of equipment because it happened so long ago, it's filled in. You can't see a crater anymore. But with this kind of ground-penetrating radar, you can tell that something happened here in this circle. This is different material than that. And this is the Sudbury crater in Canada. It's 120 miles in diameter, 120 miles. They estimate the asteroid was about 6 to 8 miles in diameter that hit. But this was 1.8 million years ago, a long time ago. And then there's the Vredefort crater in South Africa. And again, it's filled in because it happened 2 billion years ago. It's 99 miles in diameter. Again, an asteroid somewhere between 6 and 9 miles, probably. And it happened 2 billion years ago. And then there's one that hit the, I don't know how to pronounce this exactly, Chicxulub crater in the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico. This is the Yucatan Peninsula. It hit half on land and half in the Gulf. And it's about 112 miles across in diameter. They believe an asteroid of maybe 75 miles in diameter hit 66 million years ago. Yeah, but so these were a long time ago. But the scientists say, well, that's what killed all the dinosaurs, some asteroid. So how are we going to survive, or how are people on Earth going to survive when an asteroid the size of a mountain hits? Well, it may not be 120 miles in diameter, but it doesn't take, to produce a 120 mile diameter crater, they estimate you only need about a 6 to 8 mile diameter asteroid to do that much damage. Let me go back to the Sudbury crater, and I'll show you one that you can actually still see the crater. But I'm going to put it on top of the Sudbury crater, and it's roughly to scale. Okay? So that. You see that beautiful crater there? Well, can't see much of it, can you? So let me blow it up. But I've given you the scale there. This one is only about, it's less than a mile wide, the crater. It's about 4,000 feet. The asteroid, they estimate, was around between 100 and 170 feet in diameter. This one happened 55,000 years ago. So this is a relatively young one. It hasn't filled in. Of course, it's out in a dry desert place anyway. But it gives you a feeling for just what that means when something the size of a mountain impacts the Earth. talk about disasters. All right, and then you have Revelation 8, verse 10 and 11. The third angel sounded, and a great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch. That sounds like a comet, doesn't it? It fell on a third of the rivers and on the springs of water. The name of the star is Wormwood. A third of the waters became wormwood, and many men died from the water because it was made bitter. There goes the drinking water. How long can you live without water? Not long. Now, this is somewhere between a year and 5 months before Christ returns. This is the third trump. So this is a ways out. And then the seventh seal, the seventh trump, the seventh and last plagues, the second plague, Revelation 16:3. Then the second angel poured out his bowl on the sea, and it became blood as of a dead man, and every living creature in the sea died. All right, so now another food source is gone. And then the fifth sky falling episode, Revelation 16:4. Then the third angel poured out his bowl on the rivers and springs of water, and they became blood. And then episode 6, then the fourth angel poured, this is Revelation 16:8, then the fourth angel poured out his bowl on the sun, and power was given to scorch the earth with fire. Now it's been dark for who knows how long, and all of a sudden it becomes blazing hot. And so we have all these things, and then there's one more. Christ on the Mount of Olives. Zechariah 14, first verse 4. And in that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives shall be split in two from east to west, making a very large valley. Half of the mountain shall move towards the north and half towards the south. And then verse 8. And in that day it shall be that living water shall flow from Jerusalem, half of them towards the eastern sea and half towards the western sea. In both summer and winter it shall occur. And if that water wasn't flowing, there wouldn't be any to drink probably in that whole area. And then in verse 10 of Zechariah 14, all the land shall be turned into a plain from Geba to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem. Jerusalem shall be raised up and inhabited. In her place from Benjamin's gate to the place of the first gate and the corner gate, and from the tower of Hananel to the king's wine presses. And I'll let Mr. Sanderlands tell you where all those gates are in his next sermon. You can give part three and tell us where those gates are. But let's look at a map here. Here's the old city. Here's the Temple Mount right here. And here's the Mount of Olives. And that's going to split in two. It's going to open up. But it says more than that. Here, looking at the map of central Israel, let me put a... It said there's going to be suddenly a plain, a flat plain area from Geba, which is up here, and they think Rimmon is down in this area, about 30 or 40 mile area here, where it's suddenly going to be a plain, with one exception. The temple area is going to rise up. Everything else is going to flatten out. Mount of Olives will be no more. It folds open. Now here's a better view that kind of gives you a feeling of the lay of the land here. Now, there's a mountain, well, mountain range may be an exaggeration. These are more hills than mountains. Mount of Olives is about 2,500 above sea level. But if you're standing in the Kidron Valley, I don't know, it's even 400 feet to the top. It's not that far to the top. But in any case, you know, what we're talking about here is the Mount of Olives is going to split open. There's going to be a channel running to the sea, and to the Mediterranean Sea, and one to the Dead Sea. And here's another one that shows an exaggerated vertical scale here. Mount of Olives is right over here, and this is the Temple Mount area. And so what's going to happen here is this part is going to raise, and everything else around this is going to lower, and this is going to, this part of the Mount Olives that you can see here, going to split right open. So this whole geography of this place, area, will change dramatically. All right. So I begin with the question, what would be the status on the day after the day of the Lord? Let's summarize it. Earth as we know it is now gone. Like I said earlier, you come back as a spirit being and you'll wonder, what planet has God sent me to? Because I don't recognize this one. It's just not going to exist in the form that we know now. Massive earthquakes and volcanoes will have destroyed lives and infrastructure all over the world. And we've looked at, five different earthquake actions. Earth's celestial position has changed. The whole Earth itself is going to be rocked out of orbit, out of tilt, whatever. Doesn't give the details, but it's going to be rocked. Loss of sunlight over an extended period of time will have damaged any food supplies that we have. Celestial events will have destroyed the lives, crops, and marine life. And at least one-third of the world's population will have died, and probably closer to two-thirds of humanity will have died. We do have a number given in Revelation 9, verse 18. And, you know, I didn't mention the sixth trump, where the Euphrates is dried up and the 2 million-man army comes across and meets with the beast army. And there's basically a global war, probably nuclear war of some form. But it's talking about that specific event and says, by these three plagues, a third of mankind was killed by the fire, the smoke, and the brimstone, which came out of their mouths. So just this one event, this battle of war, is going to kill a third of the earth. And all these other events probably have come close to killing another third or more. Now, if the population is about the same as it is today, about 7 billion. Yeah, there might be a little over a billion left, but probably not that many even. Utter destruction. So, the question is, how will we go from this? Well, I've got one more scripture, excuse me. Isaiah 28, verse 22. Now, therefore, do not be mockers, for I have heard from the Lord God of hosts a destruction determined even upon the whole earth. This is a total earthwide destruction. That's the condition the day after the day of the Lord. So how do we go from this to this? How do we do that? You will have a lot to do with it yourself. And so I meant to give all this in one sermon, but it just took too much. So I'll be speaking the Sabbath after the feast, and I'll tell you how we go from total destruction to the Garden of Eden in God's kingdom.